everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very happy to have Carl Bontempo on the show, and we'll be talking about his new tome, Americans at the Gate, the United States and Refugees During the Cold War. When I was in high school in Kansas, lo so many years ago, there appeared among us what to us were a very odd group of people, and these were Vietnamese refugees. They were, in fact, boat people. We didn't know it at the time. We really didn't understand the international context that had brought them to Wichita, but we were certainly aware that they were there. This is actually an old story, as Carl will tell us in the interview. The United States has been interested in helping refugees since World War II. We've had a kind of love-hate relationship with it. It was an integral part of American foreign policy during the Cold War, but there were those who opposed it. Now it's come to the fore again as we find ourselves trying to withdraw from another conflict that will certainly leave a lot of refugees. So it's a very timely book as well. I enjoyed very much talking with Carl about the United States and refugees during the Cold War, and I think you will as well. Here's the interview. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing well today. How are you?
I'm very well. It's sunny here in Iowa. How is it? You're in New York, yes?
I'm in Albany. Albany, yep. Yes, it's actually quite nice today. It's cloudy, but we have peaked into almost 50 degrees, which is great for us.
Yeah, it gets above zero here, and we feel that way.
Oh, that's...
No, that's not true.
It's really... No, but I understand, because we were in the deep freeze recently, too, but now the brown snow is melting a little bit, and this is a nice thing.
Yeah, no, it's very nice here. I should say it's extraordinarily nice here in Iowa right now. I should tell our listeners that we're very pleased to have Carl Bontempo on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, Americans at the Gate, the United States and Refugees During the Cold War. New mouth, just got it. During the Cold War. I'll edit that out. So, Carl, maybe we could begin by just asking you to say a few words about yourself, that is, where you're from, how you became interested in history, where you went to school, and how you came to write this book.
Great. Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and grew up in the Northern Virginia suburbs and didn't go that far away to go to university. I ended up at Georgetown University, mm-hmm. where with long family connections. My mother was a graduate student there in history, actually. Mm-hmm. Managed to she actually stopped the program. I think she was halfway through her coursework towards the PhD, and my dad went to med school there. So we have
really
a long history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we were huge Georgetown basketball fans,
yeah,
during the Patrick Ewing era. So
I remember
that,
it well.
That sealed the deal.
Yeah.
So I went to school at Georgetown and finished up in the early 90s with a history degree. And then I guess I did something a little bit off the normal path. I did two things, actually. The first thing I did was I worked in a foreign policy think tank, and then did some consulting in foreign policy,
mm-hmm.
Specifically in U.S. African affairs,
mm-hmm.
And that was a fantastic experience. And while I was doing that, I was playing in a punk rock band, and yes, you can see it's not the normal trajectory, I think. So I played in a punk rock band and made a bunch of records.
Uh-huh. Do you want to name the band?
Sure. We were called My Life in Rain, and that's like the precipitation.
Got it.
Uh-huh. And we did that. I did that for about, well, it started when I was in university, and then we did that for 6 or 7 years. We put out three CDs, uh-huh. which are still available out there, and we don't get any royalties for them.
Oh,
so nobody's going to juice the sales. And I did that for 6 or 7 years. And then decided to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Our last CD came out while I was in my first semester of graduate school,
mm-hmm.
and I went to graduate school at the University of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Where I started off. I think this is, I don't know, is this normal? I started off in mid 19th century American history,
mm-hmm.
and then decided that was not for me,
mm-hmm.
Wrote a master's thesis and said goodbye to the 19th century, and then moved into mid-20th century foreign policy,
mm-hmm.
And sort of morphed into a foreign policy / political historian midway through the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's normal. I don't think there's anything abnormal about that. Whenever I look at graduate applications, I'm always a little bit amazed why people have these very specific projects. I said, I'm going to come to graduate school and I'm going to study footwear in Bulgaria in the early 19th century, specifically in 1806. And I'm like, how do you know that's what you're going to study? I mean, how can you know? It's almost impossible. I started one place and ended up quite a different place. So
I think it's a good thing. I think it should be to use the phrase that you see in like reality TV now. It should be a journey, and you just don't know where you're going to end up, and that's okay. It should be. You learn so much in graduate school, and you learn what you really love and what you find just interesting. And so, I think I agree with you. I'm a little suspicious of folks who have their entire research agenda for their life mapped out. Yeah. But either way, I ended up doing this sort of hybridized study of foreign policy and American politics. And my advisor was Nelson Lichtenstein, who's a very, very well-known labor historian. And Nelson was fantastic as an advisor. And he really let me study what I wanted to study, and write on what I wanted to write on, which I think is something that I've taken forward as I now, you know, work with some graduate students and work with advanced undergraduates, that you have to let students pursue their passions. And so Nelson was fully supportive when I came to this idea of working on U.S. policy towards refugees. And the project actually originated in the work that I did in Washington, D.C., in the foreign policy world, because when I was working in U.S. African affairs in the mid-90s, this was just after Rwanda and the genocide there, and in fact, it was during the collapse of Zaire. And the two people I worked for at the consulting firm were both former high government officials in the United States. One worked at the Department of Defense, and the other one worked at the State Department, and had you know decades of experience in African affairs. And I remember one of them was getting ready to go meet with refugee advocates, NGOs, and people like that. During the Zaire crisis. And what happened when Zaire collapsed, when Mobutu's regime collapsed, was that there ended up being a massive refugee crisis in eastern Zaire, which bordered Rwanda. And the borders are very very easy to pass over in that part of the world. And so you had Rwandans and Zaireans mixing together and all of them in pretty horrible, dire circumstances. And I remember my boss saying to me as he went to the NGO meeting, he said, I don't know what I'm going to tell these people because the U.S. government's not going to do anything. It got me to think, well, why not? And is there a history to this? Have we helped in the past? If so, under what conditions? So that's sort of what sparked the book.
Well, it's a terrifically timely topic, as I said to you in the pre-interview, especially now that we're trying to wind down the Iraq war. I think we will face similar questions as we try to figure out what to do with the Iraqis who have been our allies and helpers there, and I pray for wisdom on the part of the people who are going to decide. But let me begin with a very elementary question.
Sure.
And it is dealt with in the book, but I found it kind of interesting because I'd never really asked it, and that is, well, what exactly is a refugee, a political refugee, and what are the historical origins of the notion of a political refugee?
That's a great question, and it's an interesting concept. I like to explain it sort of, and this is not maybe the technical terms that one would use, but we ought to differentiate between refugee and immigrant, because I think that's an important distinction to draw. And the distinction that I draw is that, in general, immigrants choose to leave their country, and they choose to leave it under different circumstances, and some of those are hardship circumstances, whereas refugees are forced or chased out of their countries. And I know that's it's an important distinction. I know it's sometimes the two categories can be smooshed together, but in fact it's very important. And what we've seen over the 20th century really in American life and American refugee policy certainly is the definition of refugee becomes more and more politicized and more particular. So whereas in the early 20th century, you might have refugees from earthquakes, for instance, or natural disasters, and that's the term that's used a fair amount, as well as refugees from political circumstances, fleeing political persecution. By the 1950s, and then this, I think, really does continue to this day, refugee comes to mean really just that person fleeing political persecution. And this is part of the process that I think about in the book. Now, there's one issue that sort of confuses or makes it a little more complicated, this story, and that is what do you do with so-called economic refugees? People fleeing tough economic circumstances. And what's interesting about that term, and you see it a fair amount in debates in the 60s and the 70s, especially dealing with Haitians fleeing the repressive regime there, the term economic refugee at first was a pejorative used by restrictionists, people who wanted to keep refugees out, because they basically said, listen, the only people who are refugees are people fleeing political persecution. If you're fleeing economic circumstances, that doesn't make you a refugee. That makes you basically a traditional immigrant. And so this is a distinction that's also drawn as is an economic refugee and a political refugee. And in general, U.S. policy has really favored the political refugees.
Did any country in the 19th century have a refugee policy? And the reason I ask this is, you know, from my own experience of studying Russian history, I know that the Bolsheviks and people in other radical parties were basically driven out of Russia in the 19th century. And Lenin famously spent a lot of his life in Geneva. But I don't think that, you know, the Swiss had any, or the French in some cases, had any refugee policy. They just went.
No, yeah, it's not. It's interesting. There's two things I think going on there when we think about the 19th century and maybe even before. And one, and this is certainly the case in the United States, is that the United States really couldn't control its own borders, didn't try to control its own borders to any great degree until the 1870s and 1880s. And so, therefore, there's an idea of refugees out there, people fleeing political persecution. But the U.S. government, for instance, has no apparatus. It doesn't have an immigration apparatus or bureaucracy that's designed to try and say, okay, you can come in and you cannot for these various reasons. And so while we have French refugees fleeing the revolution in the 1790s, I mean, we would recognize them as refugees. We have refugees from Europe fleeing in the revolutions of the 1840s, and some of them come to the United States, and we would recognize them as refugees. There's no real policy, U.S. government policy towards them, and I think internationally you have a similar dynamic, and this was the second point I wanted to make, which is that internationally, this idea of a refugee and sort of legally encoded in international statutes and in the way that foreign policy people, experts and politicians and lawyers talk about refugees as a category doesn't really come into being until the early part of the 20th century. And that's a process that I think is an event that occurs along with the process of the destruction of empires in Europe, and the solidification of these new nation states,
mm-hmm.
in which thinking about citizenship and who belongs really mm-hmm. takes on a big, big, big part of the political culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting. So let's actually go to just that question. And, you know, from my very superficial knowledge of the history of American immigration, there was this thing called the open door policy, which may be myth or not, I don't know. And then that door was closed. And at that point, we do get a refugee policy. So maybe you can take us from the beginning of the open door policy through its conclusion.
Right. No, and this is one of the things that the book tries to do, is to think about what's the relationship between immigration policy and refugee policy,
mm-hmm.
Because I'll rely on my musical past, I guess, in explaining it. I sort of view immigration policy as kind of the backbeat
mm-hmm.
Of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there, and it's always important because it sort of sets the parameters of what mm-hmm. what the refugee policy mm-hmm. is going to be, but it's not necessarily determinative of mm-hmm. of what refugee policy might be.
Mm-hmm.
So immigration relatively to the United States is through an open door, at least until the late 19th century, and we start to see a whole host of laws, and I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with the Chinese Exclusion Act and things like that in the late 19th century that begin to shut the open door to immigrants just a little bit. And that process accelerates in the 1910s and 1920s in the wake of really the mass immigration from Europe at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when,
mm-hmm.
you know, literally we were seeing, or Americans were seeing between 1905 and 1914, on average, 1 million immigrants entered
mm-hmm.
each year,
mm-hmm.
each year, which is a really large
mm-hmm.
number, especially relative to the population.
Mm-hmm.
And so this spurs a crisis, a sense of crisis, and restrictionists, those anti-immigrant activists and politicians, push through a whole set of laws in the 1910s and 1920s called the National Origins Quota laws that essentially shut the open door in two ways. They shut the open door by, one, severely, severely limiting the total number of immigrants who could come in, and then also saying, of those who could come in, we're going to favor Europeans from England and from North Western Europe in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so this system is in effect until 1965, the national
mm-hmm.
origin system.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. What's interesting is during this period of the open door being closed, we do get a American refugee policy, an
mm-hmm.
American commitment to refugees.
Mm-hmm. And what are its origins? Do they have to do with I, of course, know the answer to these questions because I've read the book, but our listeners know, do they have to do with the rise of the Nazis and the flight of those they oppressed?
Well, in part, it does have to do with that, but what's interesting to me is that really in the 1930s, and this is sort of the starting point for the book, and whenever I get folks who ask me who aren't historians, well, what's the book about? I sort of say to them, well, you know, we all know the story in the 1930s about
mm-hmm.
how the United States shut its door to refugees from
mm-hmm.
Europe. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we're all familiar with that story. And the peculiar thing is that in the, I guess, six decades after that, the United States lets in 4 million refugees.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what changes? What happens? And so I really think that one of the things that was interesting to me, actually, Marshall, in doing the project was I sort of figured that the Holocaust and the experience of the 1930s would cast this long shadow
mm-hmm.
over American refugee policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually really surprised by the degree to which that shadow was a lot smaller, a lot
mm-hmm.
shorter than I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think what happens, and this is what I write about in the book, is that in the 1940s, in the 1950s, spurred on especially by the Cold War, but also by changes at home. These are political changes and cultural changes. You see the development, very piecemeal, of efforts to help refugees, especially in Europe.
Like one of the things actually I found interesting is I was wondering about this because I know some Armenian people, and I always wondered how they got to the United States. And actually, your book told me, and that is that in the after the Armenian genocide, there was a great influx or attempted influx of Armenians to the United States, and that
right.
that itself caused a kind of crisis.
Yes, it did. It did. It did. I mean, this is one of the first times in the 20s that the 10s and 20s that the U.S. government starts to you see attempts, legislative attempts, to try to bring in bring in refugees, and specifically Armenians. I mean, this is actually one of the first definitions that we can find of the term refugee is actually in reference to the Armenian crisis.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if I recall from the book correctly, it's been a number of days since I read it, but the original American legal definition of refugee meant Armenian.
Yes, there was no expansive definition of refugee that said, okay, and we're going to apply this to Armenians. It was literally, these are Armenian refugees we want to bring in. And in the future, that definition was sort of played with and adjusted to become something a little more universal, or in some cases actually not universal at all. They would cross out, for instance, the word Armenian and write in the word Russian. So it's a situation where we went from where the U.S. government went from sort of very particular circumstances of a certain refugee crisis and used that to try to fashion a more universal definition later on, and that is in the 1940s and 50s when you really do see, and this is the first time you really do see the development of in more conceptual terms this definition of a refugee, and here it's clear that it's based on political persecution, and the limiting factor oftentimes is that you have to be, if you're a refugee, you have to be fleeing from a certain part of the world. And that certain part of the world was in the 1940s and 1950s, Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
Yeah, before we get to that, why exactly were the well, there are a couple of questions I had, and one that really piqued my interest was that the quota on Germans in the 1930s often wasn't met, and it wasn't even nearly met. That is to say, we said that we were going to take 100, and we took 10. Now, is that because of administrative foot dragging, or because of lack of applicants, or why exactly was that?
It was, and a bunch of historians, most notably David Wyman, have written on this story. But I think it's largely attributed to, and I think you know, historians have been very good on this. It's largely attributed to administrative foot dragging that you see in the. You're exactly right. In the 1930s, the U.S. government does have quotas for Germans and Austrians, and those quotas are, you know, sometimes only 5%.
Yeah,
still.
Yeah. I was amazed to see that in the book. I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, and it's clearly it's sort of administrative foot dragging, but on two levels. In the one case, you've got sort of the high level policymakers in Washington D.C., people sort of in the upper echelons of the State Department, who are who have some anti-Semitic leanings, to say the least, and they don't want to see Jews brought to the United States, and so they're trying to put a clamp down on admissions. And then at the same time, it's interesting, the folks who are actually on the ground in the consulates in Europe are being ordered to pursue these cases very judiciously and very vigorously. For instance, that meant there was something called the likely to become a public charge clause, the LPC clause. And it was instituted by Hoover, and FDR kept it on the books. And basically what it said is, if you're going to immigrate to the United States, if you're going to be one of these people who gets one of these prized visas, takes up a quota slot, then you have to prove that you are not going to become, you are not likely to become a public charge in the United States, i.e. end up on welfare. And so this had involved submitting all sorts of paperwork and literally letters of almost like letters of recommendation from people in the United States who would vouch that you won't become a public charge. And this is, I mean, you can just imagine, first of all, if you're a refugee or a potential refugee, you're thinking about uprooting your entire family and leaving behind your home country and just how traumatic that is. And then on top of that, you know, you've got to get all this paperwork in line and get it all organized with people in the United States. And this is why I think in many ways, you know, David Wyman's book, classic book on this subject, is perfectly titled. He calls it Paper Walls.
I see. Okay.
And that's what people had to surmount. And those paper walls are pretty formidable.
I see. So let's move on past the 1930s and actually into the final years of the Second World War, where we encounter the displaced person crisis. I think this is a much undertold story in general. I know a few people are working on it, but millions of Europeans without homes, many of whom want to come to the United States. And it's really at this moment, isn't it, that legislators begin to seriously think about a new refugee policy, isn't it?
That is the case. Yes, the sort of crisis that unfolds in Europe after the war is immense, and it's a story that's well told. But it's something that, you know, I think we tend to forget just how wrecked that world was, that part of the world was, and you've got, you know, anywhere between 8 and 11 million displaced persons all across Europe, many of them residing in camps run by the United States military or by the, you know, also by the British and the French. The question is then, what do you do? What do you do with these folks? Many of them are resettled in Europe or repatriated, and some of them forcibly so back behind what, you know, is emerging as the Iron Curtain. But that still leaves, you know, several million in camps. And what we see in the United States is that there's a real effort made to open up the doors to the United States to bring them in. And I think that effort involves two things. One is sort of foreign policy thinking. And here it's actually quite interesting, because what I find most striking about the DP crisis, and that's what we call that, that sort of post-war refugee crisis, the DP crisis. What I find most striking there, foreign policy-wise, is that as much as the foreign policy reasons for admitting these refugees are based in the Cold War, and they are, that the emerging Cold War, they are at least in part based in thinking about countering the Soviet Union, they're very much so based in thinking about this problem as a leftover problem from World War II. So it's as much backward-looking as forward-looking. And I think that's really important to remember. And then domestically, what you see is you see a president, Truman, who is being pressured by any number of his constituents to deal with this problem. And you see ethnic organizations and religious organizations who really do make up, you know, a good portion of the New Deal coalition that that Truman is trying to hold together, and they're pushing him to admit these displaced persons. And so I think, you know, this combines with a general in the United States by the 1940s, you know, a sense of pride in cultural diversity, what, you know, pluralism writ large, right? You get that in the 1940s and 1950s, and these folks are making this sort of pluralistic argument to Truman that this is what makes America strong, and we should bring them in. And Truman actually does believe that, but he also believes he's a good politician, and he knows if I keep these constituents happy, this is good for me in the long run. And so that's what brings them in. It brings the DPs in the 1940s.
About how many came?
Around 400,000.
I see. Okay.
End up coming.
Yeah. So it's not a very large number, really, compared to late 19th century immigration.
No, not at all. Yeah, yeah. Not at all. But when you compare it with what the immigration quota numbers are in the late 1940s, early 1950s, you know, your annual quotas, you know, from Europe and from that part of the world is probably around 150,000.
I see.
So it's a pretty big number in comparison.
I see. So once we had worked our way through the DPs, what became of American refugee policy?
Well, that's what's interesting to me, at least, is because, and I make this argument in the book, that the first Cold War refugee policy really begins in 1953 with something called the Refugee Relief Program, and I make that argument because I really do see the DP program of the 1940s as a transitional program that moves us from World War II into the Cold War. It's got elements of both. Whereas the Refugee Relief Program, there's no question, it is targeted at refugees from communism, and it's really it's a fascinating episode, I think, because it's forged in really the cauldron of the Cold War. Eisenhower has taken over from Truman. He is told by his experts in the State Department that one way to help stabilize Europe politically and economically is to relieve some of these population pressures. And one of the ways to do that is to admit refugees. It has the added bonus, of course, of being sort of a stick in the eye of the Soviet Union, you know,
right.
A graphic representation of America as this beacon of liberty and freedom, and the Soviet Union as this oppressive communist monolith that crushes individuals. And so it has that type of advantage as well. And so Eisenhower pushes through this law called the Refugee Relief Act, and it basically provides for the admission of about 200,000 refugees over 3 years. And the entire debate, I mean, it's a fascinating debate to read in the congressional record and in the newspapers too. The entire debate is colored by the Cold War and how this will affect American relations with the Soviet Union. But what's just as interesting is it's colored by the domestic Cold War as well. These fears of communism that, you know, when we think about this era of McCarthyism, that's what I'm referring to. And obviously it's not just McCarthy, but it's this era of the Red Scare. And you see that color refugee politics and policymaking as they're designing this law, these concerns about infiltration and subversion. And so the Refugee Relief Act builds in these amazing set of benchmarks of paperwork of paper walls in some ways that really set the bar pretty high for folks who might be applying to come in under this law. And so what's interesting to me is and this sort of gets to something that I deal with throughout the book. I sort of assumed when I started this project, and I sort of assumed, like much of the literature did, that once a law is passed, you know, once the president and Congress agree and they say, okay, let's bring in this number of refugees, then all of a sudden, you know, this number of refugees would actually be admitted. And so what I – and this is partially a lesson that I learned from the folks who studied the 1930s. What I learned was that, in fact, that's not the case. It doesn't just happen. You've got to get these refugees through the admissions process. They've got to get themselves through it. And that in many cases, the admissions process is where these battles are again fought about whether or not the U.S. should be admitting refugees. And so you see this particularly in the case of the Refugee Relief Program, because over the first 18 months of the program, they let in, I mean, literally like they let in like maybe 1,000 people. And the thing is only going to run for 3 years. So if you do the math, they're not going to actually admit you know, 200,000 people over 3 years, they're going to admit, if they keep up at that pace, about 2,000 people over three years, which is amazing when you think about it. It's a totally obstructionist program at its beginning. And so I look at how and why that happened. And what I find is that the program is set up almost to fail. It's run by this fellow by the name of Scott McCloud, who is a true believer in the anti-communist cause. Good friends with McCarthy, good friends with Senators Pat McCarran and Stiles Bridges, and those two are sort of infamous in their anti-communism. And McCloud runs this program and staffs it with the intent of screening out and preventing entry of anybody who might be a threat, who might be seen as subversive. And he does this quite effectively to the point where literally nobody is getting in, which the Eisenhower administration says, this is not good. We can't have this. This is a political problem. And again, this gets back to this idea of domestic politics influencing American refugee policies, because, you know, Eisenhower in 52 runs for the presidency on this idea of, or one of his ideas is this rollback, or at least a much more aggressive posture towards the Soviet Union. And in doing so, he's trying to court Eastern European voters in the United States. And one of the ways you can do that is by letting their brethren, sometimes their relatives, into the country via this refugee program. And what he's finding is, I mean, he does make inroads into these ethnic groups in the 52 election. And these are groups that had previously voted Democratic, and so he's feeling pretty good about that. And then along comes this refugee program, which it gets passed, and that's another feather in his cap for those types of voters. And then he finds that nobody's actually getting in, which gets those ethnic groups angry. And so he and Dulles make the executive decision to remove, or rather demote in some ways, Mr. McCloud. And it's amazing, over the last 18 months of the program, refugees pour into the country.
It seems to me that one of the things that comes out in your book is that to a significant degree, both American refugee policy and our political administrative will to allow refugees into the United States is driven by events. And a good example is Hungary in 56, where, you know, I don't know if – I mean, I suppose a Hungarian American would tell me about the long-running friendship of the United States and Hungary, but I don't know anything about it.
Right.
And, but all of a sudden, we become very interested in Hungary.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a – I mean, it's a great observation, because you're right. In the largest sense, and this is something that the book tracks, is that crises drive American refugee policies until 1980. And so Hungary is a perfect example. But I would add on to that, Hungary, Cuba, with the fall of the Batista government in 1959, and then, of course, the problems in Indochina in the 1970s. These are all huge crises, and they are dealt with. These refugee crises are dealt with in a piecemeal fashion.
And so
events in 1956, where in Hungary you have the Soviet Union crushing the rebellion, the revolution, you know, sending Hungarians fleeing into Austria, potentially destabilizing Austria, and at the same time the U.S. really not doing anything. Eisenhower, again, had promised that rollback, and Americans surely remembered the rhetoric and were wondering, well, what's he going to do? And he decides to take a prudent course, obviously, and not intervene in the revolution, but you can't just sit and do nothing. And again, refugee admissions in this case play a symbolic role. And symbolism is important in international politics, both at home and abroad. And so it's that sort of crisis and that moment of almost a futility on the part of the United States that drives refugee admissions in the Hungarian case. And, mm-hmm. and over 40,000 Hungarians are admitted in the space of 6 or 7 months. And
yeah.
again, this, if you compare it, again, and this is part of the story I tell is, wow, in that first 18 months of the refugee relief program, nobody was getting in.
Yeah.
The barriers were immense.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hungary comes along and the barriers are considerably lower.
Mm-hmm.
And again, driven by events. I think the last thing the Eisenhower administration would want to see is these huge camps open up in Austria, and sort of that becomes the living symbol of, you know, the United States not helping these people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big problem too.
Mm-hmm.
So he really, you really see these folks get into the country quite easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to be. It's kind of interesting if you compare just the three examples that you mentioned. That is, the Hungarian case, the Cuban case, and the case of the Vietnamese or Indochinese. Because I started thinking that you know, that the doors are open to these people when the issue enters a kind of consequential phase in American politics. In other words, where somebody very important, like the president, feels that he could be damaged politically. But I don't know, in the Hungarian case, I suppose maybe he could have been damaged politically. In the Cuban case, more likely. In the Vietnamese case, I don't think at all, because Americans were tired of Vietnam. But yet we went through with it. So you have this kind of interesting – how would you – I know that global judgments of this sort are extraordinarily difficult, but how would you assess the balance between sort of political practicality and American idealism in the formation of these policies in these three cases?
Right. I mean, it's a great point. I think that in all of these cases, practicality and idealism are in play. And I do think, though, the difference is they're all functioning in slightly different or sometimes very different political cultures and political moments at home. And here I would say the interesting thing to me is, and I think you're absolutely right, and it's something I do talk about in the book a little bit, is that you know, by the 1970s, take the Indochinese case, the 1970s, you're absolutely right, Americans want, I think, first and foremost, to wash their hands of what had happened in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And a commitment to refugees and refugee admissions is one way that they can't do that. It
mm-hmm.
keeps them involved. And so you would think on the face of it that there's this, that there's a reason, you know, it's surprising at one level that these Indochinese refugees are admitted.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, and this is I think what's determinative in this case in the 70s, is that this is the political culture in the United States has changed immensely from the 1950s. And in this way, human rights.
Yeah, no, I was going to mention that too.
Human rights is vital to sort of an American, I think, sense of self. And if it's not human rights, it's at least a rights consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the phrase that us historians use to describe what happens in the 1960s. And so, you know, the arguments that are made to admit these refugees in the 1970s, and you see this especially on the liberal side of the spectrum, but you increasingly see it on the conservative side too,
mm-hmm.
is the argument that, listen, these folks, regardless of their value as, you know, maybe pawns in the geopolitical game that the United States is playing with the Soviet Union and others, that the important thing here is that we ought to protect and help these folks because this is a way of sustaining a commitment, a respect for human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you get in the 1970s that you just don't get in the
mm-hmm.
1950s. And that, I mean, that's an argument that actually sells, that has traction because of what happened, I think, in the United States in the 1960s with the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
with the women's rights movement,
mm-hmm.
with this flowering of rights consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, you know, I would point out that all of this it's idealistic. There are American so-called ideals at play. But on the other hand, this is all, you know, it's practical politics. It's responding
mm-hmm.
to to how the American polity thinks about itself, and the rhetoric and the language and the ideas it uses, and that's a very real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, I guess I would say it's that mix of ideals and practicality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I do find it very interesting, and I think you're exactly right about the rights talk. I mean, you couldn't ever get elected on a human rights platform and not be, well, you just couldn't get elected at all before the 1970s. And if you started to talk about universal human rights, you'd probably be called a communist.
You were called a communist.
Yeah, because they talked about universal human rights all the time. But and it was kind of cleaned up in the 1960s and then became sellable in the 1970s. And you have someone like Carter who talks a lot about it and appears to be a very pious believer in these things. And of course, he's going to accept the boat people, who, as I told you in the pre-interview, showed up in my high school. And much to our confusion, we had no idea where they came from. But they just showed up. It does make sense in that context. And also, I mean, you have to put it in the broader international context of the Helsinki Agreement on human rights and our bashing the Soviets for violating human rights. And this becomes kind of an international cudgel that we wield. And it's difficult for us to. It's difficult for us to on the one hand, claim that the Soviets aren't doing us any good here because they don't, or doing anyone any good because they don't observe human rights, and then on the other hand, we don't allow refugees into the United States. So in order to be consistent, we really kind of needed to do it.
Right. And that's true. I mean, you think about, and this is something that comes out in the book, and it's actually going to come out in my next project, I think, a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But is the fact that some of the greatest supporters of human rights in the 1970s come from the right, come from the American political right.
Mm-hmm.
People like Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington,
who is
a very conservative Democrat. Mm-hmm. He's a cold warrior through and through,
mm-hmm.
and he speaks very eloquently about human rights.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason he speaks eloquently about human rights is because he literally sees it as you put it, as a cudgel to bash the Soviet Union, and this is different than somebody like Senator Ted Kennedy, who sort of just explicitly says, listen, human rights are important because they're a path away from the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so this is a very different. They both support the admission of, for instance, Soviet Jews.
Mm-hmm.
They both believe in human rights very deeply, but they both believe in slightly and sometimes not so slightly different definitions of human rights. And they believe that they should be applied differently and to different ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very in the 1970s. I mean, it's in the end, it's actually very good for refugee admissions.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such a flexible language that it allows an expansion in many ways of the admission of refugees to the United States.
Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous tool, though. I mean, I know that in the case of the Soviet Jews, the Soviets quickly realized that our degree of investment in getting them out could be used against us, and they began to hold them hostage, basically, and say, well, we'll let them out if you do what we want. And, of course, that's not the way they would put it, but that's, in fact, the real political thing that they were doing.
Yes. No, I mean, I think it's a language, and we've seen this now in some of the latest scholarship on human rights, that it's a language that all sides are employing.
Yeah.
And because they're all employing it, then it becomes just as much a cudgel for the Soviet Union to bash
really
the American. I mean, you see it with the Soviet reaction to the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
and segregation in the United mm-hmm. States, and they call out the United States on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a two-way street, and that's what makes it an interesting language and
mm-hmm.
tool.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the Reagan administration and refugee policy, because there's a kind of a change there.
It's an intriguing moment because Reagan comes into office, and in some ways I think it's similar to what you see happen with his foreign policy more generally, which is a return to this muscular, militaristic, anti-communist anti-Soviet foreign policy
mm-hmm.
that is reminiscent much more of the early years of the Cold War than it is of the 1970s of Nixon and Ford and mm-hmm. Carter and detente. And so what Reagan does and his advisors do is they kind of roll back the clock a little bit in terms of refugee policy, because what happens in the 1980s, and this is the culmination of this sort of human rights moment, what happens in the 1980s is that for the first time, the United States passes a law that says, and there had been, it's not the first time, there were minor laws that admitted sort of very small numbers of refugees, several thousand, for instance, in the 1960s on an annual basis. But 1980, there's a big law passed called the Refugee Act. And what it does is it essentially says, the United States is going to admit about 100,000 refugees annually,
mm-hmm.
and we'll divide that up. We'll bargain between Congress and the White House. They'll bargain about who's going to get those slots.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on the books. We're going to get 100,000 refugees in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, what's interesting is the definition of refugee in the 1980 law is. Has any of those sort of anti-Soviet, anti-communist leanings, and literally geographic designations, those are all taken out.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a truly universal definition of refugee in mm-hmm. 1980, right? Mm-hmm. So for advocates of refugee admissions, this is a great moment. They're saying, wow, we've achieved so much, especially when you think about where they were 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then Reagan comes into office, and he really decides to turn back the clock, and he does so by saying, well, we're going to admit these refugees, but I'm going to make the strong case that we ought to admit first and foremost and almost, in some ways exclusively, refugees fleeing from the Soviet Union
mm-hmm.
and from communism.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's able to do in some ways is, and you see this throughout the 1980s, is return to a very Cold War-centered refugee policy,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, as those of us who grew up during this time period remember, I think, is very politically controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere is this more apparent than in Central America,
yeah.
right, where you have folks fleeing regimes of the left and the right. And Reagan is very the Reagan administration is opens the door much more to those who are fleeing regimes in the right from the right
mm-hmm.
rather than those regimes much more happy to admit refugees fleeing from communist or socialist mm-hmm. regimes and shutting the door to others. And this, of course, enrages the left,
mm-hmm.
and refugee politics becomes a way, again, politically, it's something that liberals and Democrats can bash the right with,
mm-hmm.
and this is an important political tool in the 1980s. So again, we see this sort of domestic environment really shaping the commitment to refugees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So where do we stand today in terms of refugee policy? What is our policy?
It's a good question.
I don't know.
I think President Obama might still be trying to figure that one out. What's interesting is, of course, this 1980 law that I just talked about is still on the books.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see after 9/11 was basically the borders were shut. And for 3 or 4 years after 9/11, that 100,000 quota was maybe, 25 to 50% mm-hmm. to 60% filled. And it started creeping back up very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, the question moving forward that's sort of on everybody's mind, and you mentioned it earlier, is what's going to happen in Iraq
mm-hmm.
and what's going to happen with those folks over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me at least, and obviously history is no predictor of future events, but it does suggest some parallels. And to me, the parallel here is with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And in this way, the admissions from Vietnam, the refugee admissions from Vietnam, began in 1975. Now, of course, there were refugee problems and refugee crises in Southeast Asia before that, in the late 60s and early 70s. And it really took the resolution of the geopolitical and political situation in Vietnam in 1975, right, the end of South Vietnam, to force the United States into action. And so, and the reason why the U.S. didn't launch any major efforts in the early 1970s or before the fall of South Vietnam is quite simply because if they did so, it would look like they were ready to pull out, abandon all hope,
right,
for a stable and sovereign South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be seen as an admission of defeat,
mm-hmm,
right? Why go on any longer? And mm-hmm, I do think that dynamic is kind of in play,
yeah,
in the Iraq situation, where nobody's quite sure what is going to come next. Nobody's sure how this is quite going to shake out. I think things have actually gotten a little more confusing over the last year or two in terms of the political and the sort of regional situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so any administration that is considering a large scale effort to help Iraqi refugees is going to have to weigh that against these other considerations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is going to lend itself to caution,
mm-hmm,
and they're going to wait and see how things work out. Now, obviously, this is really not good for folks who are in dire situations.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've got at one point, at least as I remember the figures, around 10% of the Iraqi population,
mm-hmm,
had been displaced,
mm-hmm,
which is an incredibly large number.
Mm-hmm.
And and then you've got these particular situations, and George Packer from The New Yorker has written very movingly about these, you know, about the Iraqi translators,
mm-hmm,
who were aligned with and worked with the American troops,
mm-hmm,
and would go out and then would find themselves obviously endangered, and then the United States basically said, you know, the Iraqi translators would come to the U.S. and come to the U.S. officials and say, listen, I'm in trouble, my family's in trouble, can you help us out? And nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get no help at all,
mm-hmm,
and would not be admitted to the United States. And this is a horrible, you know,
mm-hmm,
I mean, these are horrible stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are things, those are the particular situations. And I think actually what I think might happen is that those particular stories, as they become a little more well known, a little more, you know, part of the larger public consciousness, those are the types of stories that are going to end up animating,
mm-hmm,
and pushing forward whatever large scale refugee program emerges from the Iraq scenario.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely, and I hope that we do the right thing. I was kind of going through my mind and thinking about people that I knew who were honest-to-God refugees, and it turns out I know someone from literally every period in American refugee policy. I actually interviewed Sam Kassov. He was a DP. He was born in a DP camp.
Uh-huh.
That was a couple of weeks ago. I know at least one Hungarian refugee from 56. I think we all know Cubans who've been here. I know Koreans well who came after the war. I know one of my best friends in high school is married to a Vietnamese woman who came in the early 70s. I know innumerable Soviet Jews. I know Iranians. I know some Iranians. Actually, I just got an email from one of them the other day, and so I have no doubt that we will have new Iraqi Americans. And I really hope that we do the right thing vis-a-vis those people, because
I think it's an important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that it's an important thing, and I think it's an important thing in two ways. I mean, I think there's a way in which, and maybe this is part of something the Obama administration is thinking about, but it is a way to sort of tell the world that this is something different that we're doing, and this is a break from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in that sense, it actually helps forward, I would hope, sort of a set of interests,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's this great debate about foreign policy and about whether it reflects interests or ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a false debate because
mm-hmm.
foreign policy represents both,
mm-hmm.
But in this case with refugees, you can really make a case that, okay, it's going to help America's national security interests by creating hopefully a more stable Iraq and a more stable region. And it shows a good faith attempt, hopefully, by the United States to sort of embark upon new policies. And then at the same time, the ideals are very important, and they're ones
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we should, I think, that are worth fighting for.
Yeah.
An open country, a compassionate country,
mm-hmm.
a country that values diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And those are controversial things, certainly the diversity point is.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, if you're in the Obama administration, you could make a compelling case that this type of effort to help these folks really does forward America's interests and its ideals at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's, for me, that's what sort of cinches the case, at least as I think about it.
Well, from your lips to Barack's ears, that's what I say.
Hope.
Yeah. So anyway, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I wanted to end the interview with our traditional question, which is, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, the next project is going to be a book on human rights politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that obviously I deal with in the refugee book, and it's going to look at literally what happened to human rights politics and policies after the human rights moment of the 1970s. This
mm-hmm.
sort of flourishing of human rights talk in the
mm-hmm.
70s. And in particular, it's going to look both at, and this is where I suppose I'm doing something that's different than what others have done, it's going to look not just at foreign policy decisions, but particularly at the ways in which domestic political actors, and here I'm thinking of civil rights activists and labor activists and women's rights activists and gay rights activists, and then folks on the right like Christian evangelicals,
mm-hmm.
sort of embrace and use this language of human rights and
mm-hmm.
this idea of human rights to forward their domestic
mm-hmm.
agendas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really thinking, again, I guess we all sort of copy ourselves, as the first book was about how the international and the domestic and the interplay between them. The second book is going to have some of those same themes, but thinking about human rights in a sort of comprehensive way since the 1970s.
Well, it's a terrific project, and I hope you come on the show when you're done with it.
I would be happy to.
And that'll be in about a month then? Is that what you're...
yeah, you know, that's one of the things my parents are always asking me, when's the book going to be done? When's the book going to be done? And they finally understand that it takes, you know, 7 or 8 years or however long it takes. It takes a while. So it might be a little while, but I'd be happy to come back on the show.
Well, Carl, thanks for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Carl Bontempo about his new book, Americans at the Gate, the United States and Refugees During the Cold War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I hope you have a great week.